Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
First, Kate Elston reports from Sacramento, where thousands of people waited in line for up to 3 days for something many of us take for granted.
Andre George made a steady living as a handyman for 30 years. But 2 years ago, work dried up.
And then it got to where I couldn't afford the rent, and I lost my house, so this was my work truck.
And now it's his home. He seems to have everything he needs.
My stove, sink, microwave.
But there's one thing he doesn't have. So in late March, he drove to Sacramento's Cal Expo Center to get it. He pitched a tent and waited in line. He wasn't alone.
We got here yesterday about 10 a.m. and just set up camp.
Andre and the others weren't in line for concert tickets or the latest digital gadget. They waited up to 3 days for medical care.
I want to get my eyes checked because I can't see anything.
They've come to this, a 4-day health clinic that provides dental, vision, and medical care for free.
Are you allergic to any drugs?
No.
The clinic is run by Remote Area Medical, or RAM. The organization crisscrosses the country, providing free services to 50 million uninsured Americans.
3, 4.
It's that huge segment of the population that simply can't afford to go to the dentist or the eye doctor or the medical doctor.
Stan Brock, originally from Britain, founded the Tennessee-based RAM after being alarmed by the number of Americans without access to health care.
The people that we see here, they might as well be on the moon for the opportunity or the access that they have to the care they need.
RAM provides services ranging from physicals to free glasses. In 20 years, they've treated 500,000 people.
You know,
back in line, a day before the clinic.
My bed there, there's my son's. And
the soon-to-be patients waited.
I got my cigar box there and my little Sudoku magazine. And
Kevin Hall, who was first in line, works as a handyman and can't afford insurance.
It means a lot to me. It's awesome that something like this can be put on to help out the community. A lot of folks out there don't have insurance, and they can't afford it, and they need to have stuff done.
A few spots behind Kevin were Paige and Christina. 28-year-old Christina Gomez owes $16,000 in medical bills. She had about 17 more hours to wait.
This is definitely better than nothing. I'd rather wait here than accrue another $3,000 trying to make sure I'm okay.
Just ahead of them, Andre had been waiting 3 days plus 1 year since the last time the clinic came to town.
I heard that they were going to be coming back, and that's what I've been waiting for. You know, it's a miracle, you know, they came back.
At 5 a.m. on the clinic's first day, the crowd had swelled to over 1,000.
Worth the wait, considering.
It's almost like experiencing Black Friday.
Yeah.
116, 117.
Volunteers called patients by number, 25 at a time.
118, 119.
On this, the first morning of four, 1,087 numbers were given out.
121.
Andre's early show paid off. At number 24, he was part of the first group called inside. 5 years ago, he lost his own health insurance when he could no longer afford it. Now, within minutes, a nurse checked his vitals.
Good.
What's your name?
Andre.
Andre, I'm Jody. Nice to meet you.
It's just people that never thought they would be in this situation, that they'd have to wait in line for health care, but they're just so grateful that someone cares.
Pamela Congdon is president of RAM's California branch. Although this was RAM's 664th clinic, it's only the second year of RAM's operation in Northern California. Supported by private grants, donated equipment, and volunteers, the clinic admits anybody in need of health care.
We don't ask any questions. We don't ask for insurance. We don't ask for ID. I mean, nothing.
Which is good for Paul Sutherland, who's uninsured and needed an aching tooth pulled.
My worst problem is this tooth out here.
Without coverage, it could cost up to $500 to get a tooth extracted.
This is a blessing. I've been living with this pain for a long time, and I need to see a dentist.
Paul's one of many. 23% of Californians, 9 million people, are uninsured. That's the largest number in any state. Another 9 million do have Medi-Cal, a public plan for California's poor. But 3 years ago, the state cut Medi-Cal's dental benefits for adults. They can still get eye exams with the plan, but must pay for glasses. As a result, 85% of Ram's work here is for eyes and teeth.
So you see, they can go to the emergency room at the hospital if they hurt themselves or have the flu or some other ailment and perhaps not pay the bill. But they can't go to the emergency room at the hospital to get their teeth fixed or to get their eyes fixed.
And that's what brought Christina here. After a full eye exam, her prescription went to the portable vision lab. Here, volunteers assembled around 300 pairs of glasses a day. Within a few hours...
I've got glasses now that I can actually see with. That is kind of nice, though. I like the
colors. Can you work with them?
Like, I think the volunteers are amazing.
You can adjust it to your...
Yeah. You know, if they weren't here, then I wouldn't be able to get none of this stuff done, and I would have to suffer. I mean,
Joshua?
Yes.
Joshua Stillman was one of the clinic's 1,200 volunteers. He drove 90 miles to treat patients for 2 days.
It's a chance to give back. It's a good volunteer community thing. Help those out that can't afford it.
Are you holding up okay? Staying afloat?
All right.
At 1 p.m., hundreds of patients were still in line. Even inside the clinic, it could be hours before they've seen a doctor and can go home. By the end of the clinic's 4 days in Sacramento, 3,200 people were treated. But time ran out for some. Ram had to turn away about 1,000 people. For Andre, the day was long. He first got glasses. That took 5 hours.
I like these.
Yeah.
Then he finally got to see a dentist.
So I'm going to take a look. We're going to go ahead and take a look and see what makes sense to do, and I'll talk to you before we start doing stuff here.
It's worth it. It's been worth the 3 days I sat out in the parking lot waiting to get in here. It's been worth it.
The dentist pulled four of Andre's teeth. In the future, Andre wants to buy dentures.
We have even a couple, two or three good teeth to support a denture, you're better off.
Andre says, if the clinic can treat him, why can't the state?
We have all these dentists here that are California dentists that are willing to donate their time to do this, then why can't our state of California figure some type of policy? That should be some kind of sign to these people.
Congdon agrees that it's hard to stay silent over budget cuts to health care.
I think, like, the governor should come. I think, you know, legislators and senators should come see this and see, you know, where maybe some of those budget cuts shouldn't be eliminating all of adult dental. I mean, people shouldn't have to stand in line in our country for health care.
But until that changes, Ram may be the only option for millions. Still, Andre hopes the next time he comes to the roaming clinic, it will be for a different reason.
Hopefully I won't come back as a patient. I'll come back as a volunteer. My situation gets better. Maybe this time next year I'll have a job, you know, and some teeth. That's my my biggest hope.
Across California, the number of reported mortgage fraud cases is on the rise. For one Oakland resident, the crime hit close to home. Bronda Lyons has the story.
Bernadine Green has lived in Oakland since she was 5 years old. She married her husband at 16, started a family, and moved into her first home by 21. The third black family in her neighborhood off of 68th Avenue in East Oakland, Green has lived in her house longer than anyone else on her block.
I feel like what they call the matriarch of the neighborhood.
Over the years, Green watched many of her neighbors come and go, but she never thought she would be the one asked to leave the place she's called home for more than 50 years, the place where she raised her four children.
I felt like it was the end of my life. And I had to pray. I had to pray hard. I had to pray without getting on my knees. I had to pray ceaseless.
Her home was in foreclosure for default payments on a loan she knew nothing about. She was a victim of mortgage fraud.
We probably get at least 100 cases every quarter. I would say anywhere from 20 to 30 complaints every month. And again, that can be cyclical. There may be weeks where we get 20 to 30 just in a given week.
Someone forged her name and took out a loan on her home to fund real estate investments that went bust. She didn't realize what was going on until 3 years later in 2010 when the forger fell behind on the payments. The forger was her son, Reggie Green.
He had my back, but I didn't know he was taking the shirt off my back. It was, like I say, it was very embarrassing to find that out.
Green insists she would have never signed for a $345,000 loan because it reminded her of her deceased son, Gregory.
The loan was in the amount of the time that the doctor told me my son passed. I avoid the clock at that time of day and night, and I don't like those numbers.
Although the district attorney's office proved that her name had been forged on the loan, the bank still tried to foreclose her home. In February, State Attorney General Kamala Harris unveiled the California Homeowners Bill of Rights, which will guarantee a special grand jury to investigate financial and foreclosure crime.
So we are creating the tool through this bill that will allow us to convene a grand jury to go after bad conduct that crosses jurisdictional lines.
While the state is taking action, so is Alameda County, which offers an open-door policy to those who think they may be victims of mortgage fraud.
Because real estate fraud is so rampant, part of what we try to do is a deterrent approach. So if you were to come in and say you were the victim of crime, we don't wait for a dozen other people to walk through the door. If you have a good complaint and we're able to prove it in court to our satisfaction, then we will charge that as a crime and we will immediately start to prosecute the individuals responsible for defrauding you.
On January 20th, 2011, Reggie Green faced multiple felony charges for forgery and identity theft. He entered into a plea bargain with the district attorney's office, who reduced those charges to misdemeanors. He will not serve a day in prison for the crime that almost left his mother homeless.
In a telephone interview, Reggie Green claimed that he had legal right to sign the loan papers and that he only took the plea bargain to spare his mother the ordeal of a trial.
It hurt, but I'm afraid of him. I could never trust him again. He's the one who just divorced me, I would say.
This February, as Green was celebrating her 77th birthday, she had another reason to be happy.
On my birthday, it was late when the mail came, and I got the deeds to my house back, and I couldn't have gotten a better gift.
Over the past 5 years, her family has endured a lot, but her other son, Marlon, is hoping they can move forward.
I would like to have it to a point where we could be together again as a family. We grew up as a family, and we want to leave as a family.
For Green, that may be too much to hope for.
I'm trying to grow and get my own strength back and keep going. If he didn't care for his mother any more than what's been evident, then I have to move on and realize I've lost another son.
The recession has changed the landscape throughout much of California. Homes foreclosed, people unemployed, and now horses abandoned. Melanie Ruiz reports.
We have quarter horses, paints, thoroughbreds, warm bloods, Arabs, Morgans, Minis, ponies, donkeys, a potbelly pig. We don't discriminate based on breed here.
Raquel Van Vleck runs the 10-acre Rehorse Ranch in Jamestown, California, with the help of her husband and about 35 volunteers. Her love for horses began with annual trail rides as a child.
I did, when I was 11 years old, I went to that same riding facility and basically told them, I will do anything you want. I will shovel poop. I will do anything. Anything you ask me to do, you don't have to pay me. Please just let me come up here and be here with these horses.
When she bought the place 8 years ago, she got two horses. Now there's no time to ride them.
Everything that I wanted a horse for, those things I don't have time to do, but this is, it's so much more important and it's so much bigger than all of that stuff. You know, I would pick this in a heartbeat over the fun end of it. When you save an animal and you can rehabilitate them and find them a new wonderful home, there is nothing more gratifying in the world than that. Nothing.
Gratifying, but disturbing. Since 2007, rescue organizations report ever-rising numbers of unwanted horses. 46 of them are here at the Rehorse Ranch.
He does.
Our horses have come from every situation you can imagine, from animal cruelty cases and seizures, partnering with animal control. We have 6 different county animal control offices that we're providing support to right now.
Horse communities across the United States are suffering from the troubled economy and skyrocketing hay prices. As with the housing market, those who could barely afford horses a few years ago aren't able to anymore.
I get called on anywhere from 2 to 15 horses a day at this point. And calls from as far away as Oregon, Nevada. I got a call 2 months ago from Michigan. All of the rescues are full, and everybody's just, you know, trying to find a safe place for their animals. I have personal friends of mine that have gone out to the trails and taken their horses out trail riding. They come back, and there are three horses in their trailer that don't belong to them.
Got some of the scars on them?
He has a tattoo on the inside of his upper lip, which is how they identify horses off the racetrack. So we were actually able to research his tattoo. He won $17,000 on the track. His racing name was Casino King, so we named him Gambler.
The problem has gotten so bad that Raquel had to stop posting her address publicly. She caught several people trying to unload horses on her ranch, even tying them to the front gates.
Amazingly well. Now, this is, I think, my third call on a horse that needs a home today, and it's not even 3 o'clock.
Nonprofits, like the Rehorse Ranch, aren't the only ones getting these calls.
Someone will call us and say, hey, there's a horse in my pasture that I don't know.
Jennifer Clark manages Tuolumne County Animal Control, which gets at least 4 horse calls every week.
Abandonment used to be very, very rare. But due to the economic times, you know, people losing their homes, losing their jobs, the price of hay going up, we are starting to deal with horses actually being abandoned. You can see ribs, you can see bones.
One problem is that some people, new to rural areas, think that if they have land, they should get a horse. And once they decide they can't afford to take care of these animals, they're faced with the realities of the market. No buyers.
I have a horse we seized in August that I've still got here that I'm trying to find a home for. He's 2 years old. There's nothing medically wrong with him or behaviorally other than being a bratty two-year-old who hasn't been worked with enough, and I can't find a taker for him. That's how bad the market is.
With horses starving and being abandoned in many rural areas across the country, some horse lovers look to make a choice unheard of just a few years ago. Sending horses to slaughter.
The worst thing that could have happened in California was to ban horse slaughter, because now these poor animals are bought at market, they're shipped down to Mexico in vehicles that are made for cattle, and then they are stabbed to death. There needs to be another option.
6 months ago, Congress reinstated money for inspections of horse slaughterhouses, ending what was, in effect, a 2006 ban on U.S. horse slaughter. Some welcome the change, but enforcing humane treatment is difficult, so others don't see slaughter as a remedy for starving horses.
I don't like the idea of either thing happening to horses. I think that when they're done, that they should be humanely euthanized, and, you know, I think that they deserve that.
But that costs $400 or more. Raquel is working with local veterinarians to start low-cost euthanasia programs in Tuolumne. In the meantime, Raquel can't take horses from all the owners who call for help. It costs about $12,000 a month just to keep the current horses fed. Then there's ranch maintenance and vet bills. One emergency horse vet visit can run up to $3,000. Funding for this nonprofit ranch comes from grants and donations. 5 years ago, Raquel was working in real estate and couldn't have imagined what she'd be doing now.
We're saving lives here, and this is the most amazing thing I have ever done in my life. I have never worked so hard and been so broke. But there is a great need for what we're doing here.
Raquel has rescued, adopted, and placed more than 220 horses in the last 3 years. She hasn't had a day off in over 4 years. Woo! And she wouldn't have it any other way.
That was awesome.
I love them, and they need us. I can't imagine doing anything else. I could totally see myself out here when I'm 80 years old, shoveling turds and cruising on the tractor, and, you know, I see myself doing this until I die.
One of San Francisco's oldest industries could be making a comeback soon. Mitzi Mock tells us who's getting on board.
Early this spring, San Francisco's fashion industry came to party, celebrating local designers taking over the runway. But to really understand what a night like this means for the city of San Francisco, we have to rewind to the beginning. 7 years ago, fashion designer Joy Fan moved to San Francisco to launch a clothing line. But when she began asking locals how to manufacture clothes in the city, the response was discouraging.
It was just as though everyone talked about it like it was the past, as though it could never be done again.
If the mood seemed glum, it was because Fan showed up the same year that the city's apparel industry took a devastating blow. Once one of San Francisco's largest sectors, the garment industry was now in rapid decline as cheaper Asian-made goods flooded the market. Between 1990 and 2005, the industry dropped from 30,000 to 3,500 workers.
I was always hitting this wall towards my dream not being a possibility based on my choice of moving to San Francisco, and then absolutely fighting with that. I know this is where so many creative people are, so how do I create it so that I can manufacture and design and produce in the city that I love?
Fan began making her own clothes, first on her own and then with the help of a former factory pattern maker who was looking for work.
I feel like it's my responsibility as a designer to bring back the jobs that were completely, you know, scattered and lost, and that's exciting to me.
She's not the only one. Fan is part of a growing number of young designers who are shunning offshore production in favor of locally made clothes. Take, for example, the design students at San Francisco State.
They are the people that are graduating right now and are really interested in saying, I want to produce this. What do I need to do to make this happen?
Dr. Connie Ulasewicz spent years producing her own apparel line before becoming a design instructor.
So what's happening now in the Bay Area is that there is a resurgence of more local manufactured goods. One of the reasons for that is basically the charge of gasoline prices now. So if you're manufacturing offshore, you have to ship it in, which is much more expensive than if you're producing it in this country.
A recent study concluded that by 2015, the cost advantage of producing clothes in China will drop to 10%.
In places like Singapore and in China, because their cost of living has increased, the people, the wages that they're getting paid are not as inexpensive as they were before. Therefore, the cost of goods for people that are importing from there, they have gone up.
The reasons to manufacture locally may be growing, but there's one part of the sector that's still in danger of shrinking. When downtown garment factories began closing, thousands of dislocated workers, many of whom were Asian immigrants, were forced to find new jobs. And the few who remain may be retiring soon.
The younger people, if they got good education, if they went to school, went to college, after they come out, they don't want to be a sewing girl, or they don't want to be a cutter.
Miranda Tang has been working at National Apparel for 9 years. And she says while there's an uptick in new designers, her factory is still looking for consistent work.
We're still struggling, you know, to get more customer, you know. If we don't have enough work for them, you know, maybe, you know, 3 days a week, then they have to look for another job somewhere else. They cannot survive.
The big challenge for these factories will be holding on to their talent while they're waiting for new designers to build up enough orders to keep them busy. Hoping to boost the city's apparel industry? City Hall. San Francisco has a new initiative called Fashion SF, and its first step is to get everyone talking.
We have a survey happening right now where we're talking to all of the manufacturers that are here in the city and figuring out what is it that they need. The other piece of that is we'll be speaking with a lot of the designers to kind of figure out, well, what are the steps that they need?
The city has put together a working group that includes designers, manufacturers, and educational programs that will use this data to look for potential partnerships. They also hope to boost the allure of the industry by
creating kind of a sexy element to manufacturing again, by kind of bridging the gap between the young designers and the people that we need to build our workforce, and we can create a lot of jobs.
But producing more clothes in the city will do no good unless people buy them. And that brings us back to our party. It's a chance to showcase locally made garments to potential buyers. Fan helped organize the evening's fashion show. It's an opportunity for her to promote her own line, Vintage Joy.
So I created this fashion show because I strongly believe that there has to be a sense of consciousness for designers to be able to bridge together some sort of community. Everyone sees what a design looks like on a runway, but I have a real sense of all the different people who had touched that garment. Every person who touches it counts, and every person who looks at it, whether it be the pattern maker or the sewer or the buyer, whomever is really who touches this piece, there's a story behind it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.